Hello, this is the Love Letter Squad. I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gowan, and we welcome you to Love Letters Live, where every week, it is our pleasure to introduce you to someone who understands a life lived beautifully in some way or other. And there are always challenges to overcome in life, unexpected victories, anything that makes your life richer and gratitude-filled, we say is worth a love letter to someone. Sit down, write it, stamp it, and mail it, and make somebody else's life better. And today's guest is Judith Lassiter, who has been a yoga teacher for many years. She has her PhD in East-West psychology and is also a physical therapist. And just before, a few minutes ago, we were talking, and Judith said, well, I talk for a living, which, of course, interested me a lot. And Judith lectures, and I'm going to go right to Judith to talk about gratitude and the stories in her life that make her know that her life is gratitude-filled. So, Judith, you talk. I know you wanted to talk about your mother and a story you had and what gratitude means. Why don't you start with that, because you said something really lovely.
Well, to me, thank you, first of all, for having me on your show.
Thank you for saying yes.
I have the experience that when I truly feel grateful, it is an experience or a feeling that sort of crowds out everything else, because it is such a profound way to connect to life as it is.
You know, that's so lovely, and just as you said that it crowds out everything else, that gratitude is kind of an all-filling feeling. What does it crowd out? You had mentioned you can't feel gratitude and greed at the same time. Can you talk about that?
You can't feel grateful and greedy at the same time. They are complete opposites.
Because you're bathing in the positive so completely when you're feeling grateful?
No.
What?
It's that when you're greedy, you believe you're lacking something.
Oh, good.
And so that is not a feeling that stimulates enjoyment, presence, curiosity, love.
If you really feel with gratitude, it kind of means you're not feeling the lack of something at that point.
Yes, yeah. You're feeling full up.
Mm-hmm.
You're feeling connected to. You're feeling aware of.
Mm-hmm. So talk about, you mentioned a lesson that your mother, can you tell us about your mother?
Well, my mom is 92 years old,
mm-hmm,
and has lived a very turbulent, both up and down kind of life, had a lot of life lessons, as we say. But I remember when I was a child, there's two things I'm grateful to her for, and this is one of them. When I was a child, she read my twin brother and me a book, and it was the story of the Chirkin Goose, which was part chicken, part turkey, and part goose.
Mm-hmm.
Biologically impossible, mm-hmm, but nonetheless. And the story centered around the fact that this Chirkin Goose was ostracized and kept away from all the other barnyard creatures and made fun of and teased. And one day the wolf came and the Chirkin Goose scared him off and saved everyone. So the lesson of that story, that parable in a sense, was just because he's different doesn't mean he's wrong. And that was a lesson that echoed all the way through my life. I grew up in the South. I was lucky enough to have parents who were not racially prejudiced, but I lived in a culture where that was rampant.
Mm-hmm.
And in my home, it was very important to remember the Chirkin Goose. That was a mantra, if you will, in my family. And I think it prepared me, it created in me an attitude of openness toward difference. Different foods, different cultures, different ideas, different religions.
Did you live in a big city?
Suburb of a big city.
Mm-hmm.
And it created this whole expectation, if you will, that what was different could be exciting, interesting, open. And that has been, in many, many ways, one of the philosophical foundations that has allowed me to explore things like yoga and travel. Now, I've taught yoga on 6 continents. I'm working on Antarctica. There is yoga there, by the way.
So what is your, I mean, you must have a specific, I'm saying must, I should really ask, a specific philosophy that allows you to teach on 6 continents and take this so far? I mean, What makes you a different kind of yoga teacher who can do all this?
Well, I've just been doing it for a really long time. So I've got a whole stable of really bad jokes that I can use. I've had a lot of training in the area. I love doing it.
What do you bring to it? I mean, what's your view when you're teaching yoga?
Well, before I answer that question, I would like to talk a little bit about what yoga might mean, like what the term yoga is.
Oh, good. That's kind of what I want to know.
I was raised in Texas, and there's an expression there which is a mile wide and an inch deep.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started the practice of yoga, it was very strange, very odd, and there weren't very many people practicing it in the modern United States.
Right.
And so we were friendly, and we were connected, and it was a tight community because when I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, I either had heard of or actually knew every yoga teacher in the Bay Area.
Hmm.
And I could not even begin to say that now.
May I ask how many years ago that was, just so we have a sense of...
I moved here in 1972.
Uh-huh.
So now yoga's everywhere, and everyone thinks they know what yoga is, and people talk about yoga, and it's in movies and sitcoms. And but what has happened is that it's devolved into an exercise, which is a very small part of the practice, and not only that, a specific kind, which is sort of hot and physical and active. And if we look back at the roots of what yoga is, it mostly has to do basically with perception. It's not so much that we believe something when we see it. We actually see it when we believe it.
Oh, sure.
And I think a lot of the research now going on about the plasticity of the brain and perception is profoundly legitimizing some of the insights, the intuitive insights of human beings through the ages. So yoga is really two things. It is a state of being, of radical presence, and I say radical because the most radical thing a human being can do is to live in the present. I mean, we're eating lunch, we're talking about dinner. You know,
Oh, I know.
So then what's for dessert and what's next?
Mm-hmm.
So
you miss the moment you're in for what you're seeing.
So two things, if I may.
Sure.
First, it is a state of being. But second of all, it is a practice. And there are lots of practices in yoga, including chanting or meditating or breathing exercises or asana, which is posture, which is the most, as I said, the most familiar part. And all of these practices, though, are not the yoga. So I like to tell my students that the asana, the pose, is not the yoga. It's the residue that the asana leaves that is the yoga. And so if I may make one more point, I think the most important thing any human being can learn is something I call disidentification.
What is that?
Well, let me explain it in this way. At the end of a yoga class, especially mine, because I'm a great believer in relaxation, I like to say never pass up a chance to do nothing. There is a process where you lie down and you do a formal relaxation pose, and you imagine your eyes are closed, you're quiet, you're still, you're comfortable. You kind of let go of your arms and legs, you let go of your belly, you let go of your breath. And then there's a part where you begin to observe your thoughts. And that is really what the state of yoga is about. It is learning to disidentify with your thoughts. It's not so much that we are attempting to have a calm mind, because the mind is not calm by nature. It's always moving, even when you're asleep. But we don't have to dance away with our thoughts. We begin to disidentify. We begin to see that I am more than my thoughts. They are an epiphenomena of my consciousness. So I notice, there's a thought of greed. There's a thought of irritation. There's a thought of frustration. There's a thought of fear. There's these thoughts and beliefs that arise in me are just neurotransmitters locking into receptor sites.
Well, I have a question. What, in your own life, that's a big step to take from how you were raised to this. What in your own life made you take this turn? I mean, I don't know what, how you were raised philosophically or religiously or what the expectations were, but I'm guessing it wasn't this.
Well, I think it was the urge. No, it wasn't yoga. It was the urge that I think all human beings have, the reflective urge on some level to understand who I am and what is real and why am I here and what it's all about.
And this can live side by side with whatever your other religious or cultural...
Yoga is not a religion. So I was very involved in my church because I was... very drawn to the unseen.
Oh, that's what I'm wondering about.
I was always
life.
Sort of philosophically oriented. I remember having a conversation with my twin brother when we were about nine. We were sitting around the table eating hamburgers, not something I would do now, but we had a dog. We were feeding the dog little pieces of our hamburgers, children do under the table surreptitiously. And I looked at him and I said, how come we eat hamburger and it turns into us? And the dog eats hamburger and it turns into him. So for a nine-year-old, that was an interesting philosophical question.
And was it something you could talk to your parents about? Did they understand your need to...
Not so much. They were pretty busy earning a living and raising kids. And
more than the two of you?
No, just us. So I've always had that bent and was lucky enough through a series of what we like to call coincidences, but when you look back, you almost... can see that there was a direction. I got a job in the town where I was going to university at the Y there, the student Y, and they had a free yoga program. So for the staff, it was free. So I wandered into class one day, and it was as if the missing link was there for
That's
me.
That's what I'm wondering about.
It was a process, not even of discovery, but of recognition. This is it. So I got up the next day. I did a meditation. I did whatever I remember.
It all made
class.
Sense to you in a
It was the missing link because I had trained as a dancer for years, and I would go to church, and I noticed we could sing to God. We could pray to God. We could even give money to God, but no one danced to God. That was somehow over the line. And I felt that the practice of yoga was dancing to God.
Okay. Interesting. Now, your mother is still with us, right?
She is.
And... in Texas?
Yes.
And you talk to her frequently?
Yes.
Oh. So what is her, what's your relationship? I mean, how does she relate to what you do now?
Well,
and what about your brother?
She's very supportive in a maternal way, and she can still bend over and put her palms on the floor at 92.
Oh, good.
Doesn't
for
use a cane or anything.
Her.
She's very proud of what I do, but and in some ways, I think parts of the philosophy are hers.
In what way?
Well, I have a funny saying that it seems like in the end everyone becomes a Buddhist. And so she was reading an article once about the second arrow, which is a Buddhist idea that life shoots arrows into us. Our house burns down, we lose our job, people we love die, we get sick. Things happen. There's no way to live life without that. But we shoot a second arrow into ourselves by how we react to it. And so it was a little article she read on the second arrow. And I said, Mom, she said, I read this article on the second arrow, about a second arrow. And I said, Mom, that's a Buddhist idea. And she says, well, I don't care. I like it anyway.
So somebody who, one of our guests, I think, had said, it's not what happens to you in life that matters as much as what you do about what happens to you in life.
And this is where the process of disidentification comes
in. Which sounds
in.
Like what you're talking about.
Yes. And when we believe our thoughts, we have problems.
Awesome.
And one of the ways, actually, that I like to work with this process, other than in this relaxation pose or in meditation or... is through this idea that my words, through language, my words reflect my thoughts, my thoughts reflect my beliefs, and my beliefs run my world, especially the unexamined ones.
And is that a positive or a not so positive, or it's a matter of what you do?
It's neither. It's both.
Okay.
It's the awareness that thought is not me, and thought is only thought. So I can...
So it's kind of a very purified view.
Pardon?
Kind of a very purified view.
I think it's an eminently practical view.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an article, if I may talk about this briefly, there was an article in The New Yorker in 2008 about, and it was about perception, and buried down in the article was a fascinating relating of an experiment. So it's about perception. When we let's say that what they used was a yellow Labrador dog walking behind a white picket fence.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at that, we don't see a yellow Labrador dog walking behind a white picket fence. We see slashes
yes.
of yellow and white.
Yes.
And what we do is we get, you know how I like to say, I like to call Google the guru. I go to Google so many, because I go to Google so many times a day and I type in things and the guru knows everything in 0.27
yes.
seconds.
Yes.
And sometimes the guru even says, in forward-facing letters underlined, didn't you really
uh-huh.
mean that?
Oh, I know, I love that.
Yes, Guruji, that's what
yeah.
I meant. But anyway, so when you go to Google or any search engine and you start typing in something on your computer, it guesses what you want, right?
Uh-huh.
And it shortens the list as you type, so
yeah.
it's guessing.
Yes.
So that's what the brain does. When we look at this yellow Labrador dog walking behind this white picket fence, we are guessing, scrolling down, based on past experience. And so if a porcupine stepped out from behind the fence, we'd go, whoa.
Oh, that's for sure.
And so it seems that something like 85% or more of what we think we perceive is intrinsically generated in our own nervous system and projected out guessing on the world
mm-hmm.
based on past experience. So we're truly creating our perception.
I see. Yeah.
And
okay.
so if I know mm-hmm. that, I can't stop myself from doing it. I mean, if you look at something round that kind of something metal that has screws in it that kind of
mm-hmm.
looks like a face,
uh-huh.
it's impossible for you to look at that and not see a face.
Mm-hmm.
You can try really hard. But if we know that, if we have learned through our practice of meditation and yoga, and if we know that what I see and what I believe and what I think has been taken through my tiny little filtering mechanism, it creates a sense of non-attachment, which is not disinterest.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm willing to hear the other point of view. I'm willing to imagine that I could be wrong.
Oh, that's important.
And that gives, the very first sutra at the Yoga Anushasanam in Sanskrit of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra says, now the practice of yoga is shared, is given, is offered. And so right from the beginning, yoga is about the willingness to be present, radically, deeply present. Not because, as many spiritual traditions talk about, not because being present is the end of spiritual practice, but because it is the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
when I am present, there is a space in me for compassion to arise. And when compassion arises in me in those wonderful rare moments that it does, I always like what I say, what I do, and what I choose. And I like what that creates in the world. If I don't act from that space, I create.
So it's kind of a way of getting to your best self.
It
your
is.
Your best possibility.
Well,
a while ago, before we started to talk about this, and I know, Teresa, we have some time for, if you could just tell me this briefly, because then I have something else to ask you about a love letter. But you said you were about to give a lecture, and it was yoga can ruin your
life. Yoga will ruin
your life. Thank God.
Thank God, and thank God.
And that means in a couple of minutes. Can you tell us?
Sure.
Okay.
When one takes up deep inquiry, personal inquiry, it's not to the exclusion of the world or being a citizen of the world, but when one takes up deep inquiry, like yoga, things change for you.
Mm-hmm.
You think about things differently. You think about yourself differently. You might eat differently. You might read different things. You might choose not to spend money on this. You might choose to spend your money on that. It begins to change the way you dance with the world.
So it's a consciousness.
Yes.
A way of becoming more conscious.
I think I would say it slightly differently.
Okay, good.
Instead of becoming more conscious,
because mm-hmm.
I don't think you can become more or less conscious, I think you choose differently. you are more aware of your choices. And that's really all I can hope for. I do have another story about that.
Okay, and then I want to ask you who gets your love letter today.
All right, so here's an example of why I practice.
Mm-hmm.
So a grown daughter is off at graduate school, and she calls me up, normally a lighthearted, easygoing kid.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "Mom, I have something really important to talk to you about."
Did your heart go clutch?
My heart, yes, did a variety of flip-flops. And in my mind, based on my experience, remember the dog walking behind
mm-hmm.
Okay, she's dropped out of school. She had a wreck. Her car got stolen.
Right.
She broke up with her boyfriend. She's engaged. She's pregnant. She's unpregnant. I'm in jail. I lost
sure.
all my money.
Oh, yeah,
blah,
yeah.
blah.
Yeah.
So in that moment, there was a little, I call it a, there was a light bulb. There was one tiny little light bulb in the back of my brain, which turned on and said, whatever she says next, respond with compassion and love. Because whatever I say next could shape our relationship for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
And she said, "Now, Mom, I know you gave me $200 to buy a coat, but I found the cutest coat for, it's $50 more. Can I have another $50 to buy this coat?" And I thought, boy, she's good.
Yeah.
but it's a silly story in a way, but in another way, it's a profound story, because that's why I sit on the meditation cushion every morning for 20 minutes. So I've developed the habit of observing, and there can be a space in the back of my brain to choose how I want to be in the world.
That's such a nice story. I don't think that's a little story at all, because...
Well, it seems like a silly thing, a coat, but it actually is a profound...
Well, the story isn't the coat. The story is, who are you going to be to receive whatever it is she says? And if you're a nervous wreck, or you're perceiving things in disaster, it's going to color how you respond even to a little thing, isn't it?
Of course. And
that's lovely.
Later, I will tell you later, at some other time when we were in a more informed, we were actually together, and I said, "You know, when you called me that day, I felt really afraid when you first told me that, because I thought it was going to be something more serious. You know, and I said, so in the future, you know, maybe you could just give me a hint."
Oh, that's important, by
Later,
the way.
Later, I followed through. But in that moment, what was important was to be present with her.
Right. So you want to ask the other person to give you a tip of how critical and life-threatening or ruining it's going to be.
Yes.
Yes, how to deliver good news or bad news or difficult news on the phone is a real art. Oh, we should talk about that sometime. Okay. So tell me, if you were to write a love letter right now, given all that's in you, have you written love letters to people before?
Well, romantic kind of love letters, but not the love letter I think you're talking about.
Well, we're talking about any kind you want, but you're making a good point that we like to make, that love letters are way beyond romance and for gratitude. So if you were to write one right now, here's a pencil and paper, who would you write it to? And it doesn't have to be one person, by the way, because we like to say love letters is not a one-shot deal. It's a way of living, choosing to express gratitude.
I think you're going to be surprised.
Good.
Three people come to mind.
Good.
The first one is Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, lovely. Uh-huh.
And I know there is controversy about him and his life, but when I think about what he did and what a lot of the founders of the country did against the largest country in the world,
mm-hmm.
they risk everything for the ideal of freedom and choice. And I think that is an unbelievably precious gift that we have.
And a precious letter. And my question is now, if you write a letter, when you write a letter to Thomas Jefferson, to whom will you mail it? Because I think that's important. Whatever you write is part of your history, documented in your own handwriting. To whom, and somebody will find this in three generations, great-grandchildren, somebody who buys your house or finds it stuck in a wall or bookshelf, will know something important about you. Who will you mail this to?
Who will I mail it to? I'd probably mail it to my mom.
Lovely.
And I'd probably mail it to my kids.
Okay, good. So you already are seeing how to spread it out.
Mm-hmm. He wrote in the Declaration of Independence that we mutually pledge our lives, our honor, and our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And I've often thought, to what would I pledge my...
Mm-hmm.
my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor, to what is my highest ideal? What would I choose to commit my life? And this is not just...
So this is a nice jumping off point,
yes.
A letter to Thomas Jefferson, and then
yes.
saying what's important to you also. And you're mailing it to your mother and your children. I think to make it a real love letter is, why am I sending this? I'm sending this to you.
Because I want to reveal who I am
to
and
you.
What I've learned. Yes, I want to reveal to you.
Because you're so important in my life, because you were a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you'll hear it and you'll understand it and you'll appreciate it.
That's so nice. Okay, I think we have maybe a minute left. Can you tell us just who the other two are?
Well, I would definitely write one to my mother.
Yes.
Because of so many reasons.
Makes me want to write one to your mother just listening to you for the last.
And I think I would write the third one to myself.
Oh, good. Good. That's a lovely thing to do. And then you know where to mail it.
Because it's so easy to see the bad stuff about yourself.
Uh-huh.
Good
point.
But what do I truly appreciate about what I've done and created and given in my life?
And that's a real love letter. Yes.
Yes.
So when you mail that to yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you open it, and you read it, I mean, our experience is that the you who writes it and the you who reads it are two different people.
Yes. I could imagine that.
I think you'll be thrilled.
Thank you.
So will you use any particular kind of stationery to yourself? I like.
Oh, I'm very much into pens and nice paper.
Oh, good. Me too.
I have to pick something out.
Okay.
Very appropriate.
Yes.
Well, Judith, we're nearly out of time. Can you tell us your website
so that people can find
you?
Yes. JudithLassiter.com.
Okay. JudithLassiter.
Exactly.
.com.
Then I have restorativeyogateachers.com.
Okay. RestorativeYogaTeachers.com.
Restorative yogateachers.com. That's all right. Yogateachers.com.
We'll put it up.
Okay, perfect. Because, you know, with websites, if you don't do it exactly right, you'll never get there. Okay.
You can go to the guru and find me, too.
Yes. I know.
Google.
I know. I did that, actually. Thank you.
Well, Judith, we could talk about this for a long time. Thank you for joining us. There's so many things to follow up on.
And so many interesting thoughts.
Right. And speaking of websites, we hope that our listeners will go to our website, lovelettersquad.com, and you can catch Judith's radio program again. And most of the other programs that we've been doing for the last more than 4 years.
Yes, we're happy to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank all of our listeners. Please join us at this time every week. And in the meantime, we hope you'll put your loving thoughts into words and send them while you still have the chance.
Exactly. And when your mother is 92 years old, tomorrow is the best day to do it, right?
Yes.
Yes. And remember, please, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is always a special occasion.
So until next time, this is Teresa.
And Janet.
Saying bye.